Welcome back to the Make or Break Show, where each week bringing stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with Anne Briggs, whose range of skills and talents really do earn her the name Anne of All Trades. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to episode number 2 in 2019. And we have a really fun one for you. As always, this week we're hanging out with Anne from Anne of All Trades. You might have seen Anne on some podcasts here recently. I know she was on Made for Profit last year, as well as The Green Woodworker. And she's doing some really incredible stuff. So I wanted to bring her on. I really to get more into her kind of background and getting into where she got now. And so it's a really fun interview. But before we get into it, as always, I want to let you know, thank you so much for all your awesome support, especially those supporters over on Patreon. That's how this show can be made. And if you would like to support it, you can head over to patreon.com/makeorbreakshow. We're going to keep it pretty short, but to give you a quick bio on Anne, she is from just outside of Seattle, Washington. She actually lives on a farm with her husband and a bunch of animals. But her stuff has been kind of all over the place. She's written for Popular Woodworking. She's done stuff with Lost Art Press. She's actually done one of the guild projects with Mark Spagnolo over at the Wood Whisperer. And she does a lot of turning projects as well as fine woodworking. You might have seen her stuff popping up all over. And then more recently, she's gotten into blacksmithing, as well as a lot of like cool homesteading stuff. So she's built out her shop. Like I said earlier, she has a farm. And so she's got tons of different animals. And so she has a really cool variety of things that she's working on and a lot of different skills that she's got. So we'll kind of get into where all that came from, how she sees all that going together. And as of this recording, she's about a year into actually going full time. So we get into what it was like before she did that. What was that transition like? And then what she learned this last year, and if it was what she expected it to be starting out. So without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Anne. So I would love to get into your background a little bit. And I think you are the first one that has lived in China. And I'm guessing, can you still speak Mandarin?
I do speak Mandarin, yeah.
You were definitely the first woodworker or really maker of any type that I can think of that that has that background. But if I was doing my research right, so were your parents missionaries? So like, did you kind of grow up in that world? Is that how you got to China?
Yeah. Well, in a very convoluted way, yes and no. Okay. So my parents helped found an one of the campuses for an organization called Youth of the Mission. And so the campus is in Montana, and it's a training facility for short-term missionaries. And so I grew up there at the campus in Montana, but because, you know, my parents are missionaries, we spent quite a lot of my young life traveling abroad.
Got it.
And so then when, funnily enough, my mom made us actually pack up our stuff and like say goodbye to our friends every year. She had a dream when she was 17 that she was going to live in China. And so we always were waiting for the time we would pack up our bags and move to China. And then it just never happened. I went to university in the States here, and I just didn't really love my university, and I just needed a ticket out of there. And so I found a study abroad program, and I ended up going to Beijing, and I fell in love with it. And I at that time was like, well, this is how I'm going to spend the rest of my life. Yeah. And so after I graduated from university, then I went to, I went with Youth with a Mission to a, kind of like a seminary program in Taipei.
Oh, cool.
And to be honest, the real draw there was because it was bilingual, and I really wanted to solidify my Chinese language skills. And so I started with that, and then I ended up really loving the program. And it was really just, one of the best seasons of my life.
So did you want to live like permanently in China? Like, was that your goal, at least at that point?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, I'd still move there in a heartbeat, but my life is very much now here.
Yeah. That's really neat. So on the making or woodworking side of things growing up, like, was that also a part of your life, or were you always kind of the kid just building the things that you wanted to play with?
Yeah. We didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid. And so I definitely was, my parents were very, very creative in the way that I was entertained because I had a lot of energy and a lot of interests. And basically I was just given whatever tools, I needed to kind of hobble my hobbies together. And yeah, I spent basically my entire childhood working on go-karts, building tree forts, making miniatures. I've always been obsessed with miniature things, which you'll see often pop up in my Instagram feed. I have quite a collection of miniature toys and miniature tools and stuff. And it's definitely been an obsession of mine since I was a kid. So I did tons of claymation and stop motion videos and things like that as a kid. But, the funny thing is that my dad did not really have any tools of his own to speak of, because he's a brilliant, brilliant guy, but not someone who uses his hands as a in that way. And so my grandfather was a furniture maker, and I spent a lot of my young childhood in his shop with him, but he passed away when I was 12. And so I basically didn't have access to, you know, a sophisticated tool set anywhere outside my grandfather's shop. Any time in my life until I moved back to the States 7 years ago and started making stuff myself.
So when you were making like the go-karts and everything, was that with your granddad's tools or was it just stuff? Like you just making do with what you had?
It was definitely just making do. My dad had like a few random tools and I would just use those I had no idea what I was doing, first of all. So whatever he had was fully sufficient for whatever I needed. But yeah, I mean, I think he had an axe, a ratchet set, a couple hammers and, maybe a couple hand saws or something. And I think my grandpa's skill saw, and that was pretty much my entire toolkit most of my life.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing, and I bet we'll get into it, is it seems like you don't like worry about the fact that you don't know how to do something. You just kind of dive right into it. And so like as a kid, were you that way as well? Or was anyone ever pushing you like, oh, if you want a go-kart, you need to make it? Or you just like, forget this, I'm going to make it myself?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, basically it was either I make it myself or I don't have it because...
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. So necessity.
Yeah. So it's always a necessity. And I mean, I spent a lot of time alone as a kid. And so I just tinkered with things. I was always fascinated with how things were made. I would take them apart and put them back together and, you know, quote unquote, fix things, even though who even knows what I was actually doing there.
So do you have anything from back then still?
I think I have some of my claymation stuff. My adoptive grandparents on the other side they were very generous with us as kids, and they started giving me Playmobil toys when I was 5 years old. And so then it became a tradition that every year after that, I would get more Playmobil toys for the set. And I now have all of those, and it's quite a large collection now because it just kind of, along with my obsession with miniatures, that just stuck. And so even now as an adult, I get more Playmobil toys every year.
That's fun. So after you went through school, what would you say, what brought you back to the States?
So I met my husband. He's now my husband. He was my best friend starting when I was like 15. We were in a band together. And he lived in Seattle and he kept telling me that it was time to move back to the States. And I was like, yeah, not yet, not yet, not yet. And then finally he finagled me into coming back here and here I am now.
Gotcha. So were you guys, was it like long distance dating then when you were in China?
I mean, we were just friends for a long time, but.
Just friends. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
So did, once you came back, I know you did some work with Pratt, Fine Arts. How did you kind of get more into the woodworking world at this point?
Yeah. So when I first came back, to the States, I was teaching Chinese and it was it was a very good job. I mean, it was super cush. It was very flexible and I didn't have to work very often and it paid really well. And so basically I've worked pretty much full time or had a job and gone to school since I was 13 years old. So I'm not really that great at having like free time. And so when I worked, when I moved back here and I was only working, you know, 20, 30 hours a week, all of a sudden I was like, what the heck am I going to do with all this extra time? I need to stay busy and I need to be productive with my time. And so I was like, you know, I've always wanted to have my own tool set. And I always, you know, ever since my grandpa passed away, I always was like, you know, someday I'm going to have enough tools that I don't have to make do anymore, that I can just grab what I need and do whatever I want. And so starting basically probably, I would say probably like maybe a month or two after I got back to the States, I started buying tools on Craigslist, and I would buy a tool and fix it up and then sell it for more money, and basically just kept upgrading my tool set until I had a full working shop. And that was before we bought our farm here 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, I had a pretty rockin' shop. I had all the stuff I needed to do welding and fabrication and any kind of furniture building. They're in our two-car garage at our old house, and I was pretty pleased with that setup.
What drew you to like fine furniture building? Like, was it your granddad's influence early on, or is it something else?
I think really just I have a tendency to get extremely obsessed with things, which also you will see reflected in my social media feeds, but. Yeah, I started doing furniture, and I basically was like, well, you know, like it's not enough. I mean, I didn't grow up having nice things, and so I was like, you know, it's not enough just to make a thing. I want to make something that's really nice, and so I want to be able to make the things that I could never afford to buy. And so it just kind of devolved from there, or evolved, whichever you want to, whichever way you want to look at it. But it became an obsession. I think that first year we lived a block away from our local library. And because I just had a lot of free time, I am also a voracious reader. And I started checking out books, and I think I probably read about, you know, 300 books that first year. About woodworking and gardening and things like that. And basically just totally did a total deep dive. And it was all downhill from there.
Was there a piece that you remember, being like really proud of? Like, I can't believe I actually made this, or the way I envisioned it, on the woodworking side.
I mean, the first dovetailed bookshelf that I made all by myself. I was so proud of, and it's now in the gallery of my work, which is my mom's living room.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And yeah, that was definitely my first favorite piece. It was made out of black limba and walnut, which is a theme that you will still see in all of my work.
You said black limba? Is that what you said?
Yeah. It's also known as Peruvian walnut. The reason that using it is because it's just a dream to use with hand tools.
That's so cool. I did, I recently just built an end table for, we had a daughter in February, so she's about a year old.
Oh, congratulations.
So for her nursery. And thanks. And it was the first time doing like dovetails or anything like that. And when I look at that comparative, like how I got started with like the 2x4 kind of outdoor, like Craig jig, that kind of stuff, furniture. It's like, it feels a lot different looking at that versus the kind of the first pieces that, that you start out, at least I started out making. But you've gone super deep. I know you've written for, Pablo Woodworking. You've done stuff over, with Lost Art. Those guys are awesome. And then, how did the relationship with, Mark over at, the Wood Whisperer come about? Because you have done one of the projects right inside of the guild, and are you working on another one? Did I hear that right?
I'm not working on one yet. Put pressure on Mark. I want to do another one.
Okay, I will.
You know what? I think that was just because of social media. And honestly, in all reality, if it wasn't for social media, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, because it has connected me to an incredible community of people. And it's just such an interesting equalizer, far as when social media came along, it really leveled the playing field. And I have been offered so many opportunities that I surely did not deserve. just because of social media. I mean, literally every person that I know now and every sweet woodworking gig that I've gotten, including the job that I had at Pratt for 3 years, running the woodworking program there, that was due to social media.
When did you first get on Instagram?
I think it was 5 years ago. It's kind of crazy. Okay. I actually, I think I was one of the first Instagram users, but it was completely by accident. I had no idea it was a social media site, and you'll quickly find out that I'm the world's worst tech savvy person. Like, I don't know anything about technology. I can barely run a computer, and often it is quite hilarious that I do what I do for a living, because I could throw my computer out a window almost every single day. Like, I'm just trying to save a document and it just won't do it for me.
Right.
So it's just, So anyway, I thought Instagram was a photo editing site. And of course I didn't know how to use Photoshop. And so I was trying to make a collage for my sister's birthday, and I needed to make some of our childhood photos look like antique photos. And so I looked up how to do that or something, and someone said, and there was like a little like how to on about using this app called Instagram. And so that's, I got an Instagram, and then a few days later, someone commented on one of the pictures or something. And I was like, what? Like, how are you seeing this? This is the creepiest thing in the world. And here we are 5 years later.
Lots more random people commenting on your picture. Was that kind of the first moment you realized there was like a bigger community on the social side of things in the woodworking world?
It 100% is. So to make a very long story short, the real catalyst in getting deeply, deeply into the hand tool side of things is that my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, who lives out here, was very into it, and he was a huge proponent of all that stuff. And he gave me a copy of The Anarchist Tool Chest by Christopher Schwartz, which that book was utterly and completely life-changing for me. Like, literally, I'm living on a farm and building furniture for a living because of that book. But my brother-in-law, I didn't get to see them very often, and everything that I do is very, very, very community driven. And so the fact that I got as into woodworking as I did is also thanks to, social media, because basically within those first few posts that I accidentally made on Instagram, I met one of my friends who's now literally one of my best friends. And he was also a woodworker, and I was like, wait, there's other woodworkers here. Like, I could talk to other woodworkers through this app. Like, this is crazy. And so, once I realized that there were other woodworkers and that I could make friends that were also interested in this thing, because the crazy thing, and I'm sure this is the case across the board, I'm sure I'm not unique in this way, but I feel like the more that I got interested in woodworking, the more that it isolated me from my community, because, you know, people will be polite at a dinner party, but after about 15 minutes, like, no one wants to hear any more about dovetails or Ron Swanson or anything else. So, so it was so cool to be able to get connected to other people who were interested in the same thing. And I've always joked that Instagram is kind of like Tinder for friends, because you can, you know, really hone in and find people who have similar interests to you, and then just totally nerd out. And yeah,
that should be their new tagline, Tinder for friends. That's so good. So on the Pratt side of things for a minute. So the teaching aspect, and then I guess also the teachings that you did with the guild and the classes that you do. When you were teaching at Pratt, like, were you teaching like a woodworking course for beginners? Like, who was like the audience for that?
So I actually started out at Pratt not teaching. I was managing the woodworking education program. So I was actually hiring teachers and maintaining the shop and creating the course content and like the class schedules and those kinds of things.
Okay.
And so that was that. And it was through that I was able to basically, They offered me a job that I was very unqualified for, and like an idiot, I took it, and I'm so thankful that I did, because that those 3 years, well, 2.5 years, really, really changed my life for the better. But basically, I saw a fantastic opportunity to, you know, use my marketing skills to help out a struggling program, and also just take all the free classes possible to increase my skills, both with woodworking and blacksmithing, which is what actually the blacksmithing shop is the reason that I took the job there. Cause I was like, Oh my gosh. Okay, cool. Yeah. And yeah. So it was a really unique opportunity for me. And then during that time, you know, I did a ton of networking, and I helped them get a really solid group of teachers, hired and left a program that I'm really proud of.
It was more on the managing, almost managing the system, it sounds like, versus like teaching how to like cut a dovetail or anything like that.
Yeah. And it was, and I mean, that was, it was my, it also gave me my first opportunities to teach. So, okay. You know, if a teacher wasn't around or something, I'd fill in, and then, and I ended up doing a couple classes as well. So
what classes did you teach?
Let's see. Well, most recently I've actually been doing social media classes, but I think, I can't remember if the first time I actually ran a class was either, was at Pratt or it was at Port Townsend School of Woodworking, but I think it might've been at Port Townsend, but anyway, it was just teaching how to build a bookshelf using all the basic woodworking joints. So dovetails, mortise and tenon, and dado joints.
Got it. So Port Townsend, you still do classes with them, is that right?
Yeah, every once in a while. It's, you know, it's like a 2-hour drive, so I can't do it often, because it's just really tough for me to leave the farm for a week at a time. But yeah, I love teaching, and I will try to do it as often as I can there. So I'm teaching 2 classes there this year, and a class at Lost Art Press, and doing a couple fill-in things at Pratt, and yeah.
Going through like how you learned to do things and now flipping it to now you're teaching how to do things, like would you have initially learned differently? Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm missing that.
I'm not sure if this is answering your question, so I can re-answer if I don't. But
yeah, or just make up your own answer to a question that's somewhere, yeah, because I don't know what I'm trying to say.
But I mean, the thing for me is, once again, quite selfishly, teaching is awesome because it allows you to experience something completely new in someone else's eyes and remember what it was like for you. And then also watch 10 people make 10 different mistakes and then kind of learn from that too. And so, like when I first got started, I really wish that I had taken the time and money to take classes. Cause I was pretty much convinced, like, you know, I can afford to buy a few tools. I can't afford to take a class, because if I take a class, then that means I can't buy a tool or whatever. And that was a really, really dumb way of looking at things, to be quite frank, because I could have just taken a couple classes to get started and gotten a solid foundation, and also saved so much money not buying tools that I didn't need. And so now I really encourage everyone to take a class at the very beginning before they A, learn bad habits, or B, waste a ton of money on tools that they don't need. And so from a teaching perspective, I really like to explain the way that I do things, which invariably half the things I do are probably wrong, because I am like, you know, I learned basically everything from a book or a video or whatever else. And so, or figuring it out, which then it's probably... Yeah. Inefficient and wrong. But yeah, so when I'm teaching someone new, I really like to find something that we have to connect about. So, you know, I find out what they're interested in, and then I try to relate whatever I'm trying to explain in a way that makes sense to them or is within their wheelhouse. So, one of my favorite teachers at Pratt kind of taught me how to do that. And he is just incredible at changing his explanation for anything based on whatever it is that you say that you're interested in. And so, he talks about, he teaches wood turning. And so he'll often talk about the wood turning tools as if they're hand plane to me. And he's like, so you know how a hand plane does this? Well, this is what your turning gouge is doing when you do this. And
gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So relating things to people is very helpful. And so yeah. Again, I don't know if that really answers your question, but
no, that totally did. Yes.
Here we go.
That I don't know what I was trying to ask, but that was the answer that I think I was looking for. On the farm side of things, at what point did that kind of enter the story? Like, were you still teaching or doing the work at Pratt? And also when you got the farm, did you know that was kind of what you wanted to do, like, full time?
I'm a huge dreamer, and I'm always looking to the next thing, but I'm also a horrible planner. And so I kind of just suddenly find myself in these circumstances all the time, whatever these circumstances may be. And Pratt was very much one of those things. Again, I felt like I was very unqualified for that job, but I was really thankful that I got it. If I remember correctly, we moved to the farm and I got the job at Pratt pretty much like simultaneously. And so that was a bit of a crazy period of time because the farm was, I always said, since I was 5 years old, I always said, like, if I ever have to live in America, I will live on a farm. And so I've wanted to have a farm and have animals and pets since I was a kid because, you know, with all of our travels around the world and stuff, we couldn't have pets as a kid. So my poor husband, who I'm sure would love to live in a high rise in Seattle, ended up marrying me, who wants to live on 100 acres and have 1,000 pets. So, we got the farm and I got the job at Pratt, and suddenly I went from never having had a dog before to having 80 animals.
Oh, wow. You said 80, like 80?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. And you guys have all types of stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and every animal that we have, it's the first time I've ever had that animal. And so I have to learn all about it and how to care for it properly and how to train it and all that kind of stuff. And so it's been quite an adventure here. And then, you know, same thing at our old house, we had, I had finally convinced him to get a couple chickens, and I had a pet rabbit and a cat that someone gave me as a joke. And, cause I actually used to just totally despise cats. I actually kind of still do, but, they help us with our mice and rat population. So I tolerate them. But, so anyway, we had a garden and stuff, like a small, small garden at our other place. And then, you know, we moved here and suddenly I was like, okay, well, we've got all this space. We've got all this barn. So here we're going to have a whole bunch of animals and I'm going to have a huge garden and, here we go. So the side note too, is that we actually had not really planned on buying the farm, but, some extenuating life circumstances happened and we suddenly, needed to sell our other place and move. And we literally just fell into this place and it was the hardest and best thing that's ever happened to us.
And you said you've been there how long now?
We're almost to year four.
You're four. Okay. So at what point, or maybe all along, did you know, maybe not for the farm kind of being your full-time deal, but that you wanted to work for yourself? Like, did you kind of know that was going to be the direction you're going to wind up?
No. I've always been very entrepreneurial. I've had my own little side hustle as it's now called since I was about 5 years old. I opened my first business when I was five.
What was it?
I had like a firewood chopping business, a lawn mowing business, and also I had this little cart that I made that I'd push around the neighborhood and sell baked goods and lemonade and stuff like that.
That's so good.
I've always been very, very entrepreneurial and always had some kind of like side hustle business or whatever, but I actually, my goal was always to actually work in corporate America because I grew up with very, very few resources and I just wanted, I thought I wanted a very different life. And so I was very business focused. I went to business school and I was very excited to, you know, work in a high rise in the middle of Beijing and rake in tons of cash, and pretty much living the exact opposite of that now. But yeah, it's just funny how life and principles evolve.
So was there a turning point when you decided to go at it yourself?
When I moved back to the States, I started in corporate jobs after my little stint teaching Chinese. I had a job at Zulily, which is actually, I maybe shouldn't say the name of the company. I had a job at a tech startup. Okay. And it just turns out that I hated that life. I hated the culture, and it just was not for me. And that was a pretty huge realization, because I thought my whole life that that's what I wanted. And it turns out that I absolutely did not. And so I always had dreamed about doing something myself, or starting my own tech startup or something like that. Not necessarily in technology, but here in Seattle, it's kind of culture to call things tech startups. But basically, wanted to start some kind of business that would just totally take off. And I could imagine myself being the CEO of this whole thing. But yeah, it just turns out I totally hated that life. And so I actually, after I had started doing the furniture stuff, I think it was 2014, I actually quit my job and tried to make it as a furniture maker, and realized that that was just a completely and totally idiotic pursuit for me, because it relied on a lot of characteristics that I do not possess. And so it was a complete and total failure. And I struggle with depression and anxiety, and it just, all of that culminated in one big, bad failure. And so I went back to work, and I enjoyed the structure of going back to work. And then miraculously I was offered that job at Pratt, and that kind of was an amazing happy medium, because it gave me a ton of freedom, and I was completely responsible for my own schedule and responsible for other people. And so that gave me accountability and things that were really helpful for me to kind of turn things back around and start to woodworking again after that total flop. Yeah. And so at that point it was really, sorry, I totally lost my train of thought.
Very good.
Oh yeah. So at that point I just was maybe I could do this again. And so during the time that I was at Pratt, I started to formulate the idea that I probably could do this myself. I just would need to structure it really, really differently. And so I actually started building my business that I have now while I was at Pratt. And thankfully, my schedule was flexible enough at Pratt, and I was also dumb enough to work 120, 130 hours a week to make sure that I got things set up properly. And then last year, on January 1st, I started on my own. And this model that I've set up for myself is hopefully going to set me up for success as emotionally and also financially as well.
Yeah. Cause that, so in 2014 you were building commission pieces, it sounds like, is that
right?
Yeah. Okay. And so, is your business model more now the training aspects of what you're creating, whether that's through social media or selling plans and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely say that it relies much heavier on the teaching and the sharing side than the selling side. So the way my business model is set up now, if I sell a piece of furniture, that's great. It's just added income, but it's not, but my business does not rely on me having to sell furniture to be able to survive. And that's what's really important, because a very similar realization, a very similar theme to why I couldn't really cut it in corporate America is because it turns out I actually don't care about money at all. And it's not in any way a motivator for me, because it turns out you can have it or you cannot have it. You can still face the same kinds of problems. And while most of my childhood, I was like, you know, like, I wish I had enough money to do this or whatever. Thankfully, not having money taught me to be really, really resourceful. And as it turns out, whether I have money or don't have money, it's, I can still do the things that I want and have the attitude and the community that I want. And so that's kind of A, why I couldn't cut it in corporate America, but also B, what has helped me to realize what's actually important to me and how to kind of pursue those things. And so building furniture for a paycheck is not sustainable for me because the paycheck is not enough to inspire my creativity and my, you know, distractibility into actually getting something done, and relying on, you know, someone like basically just trying to get paid for my furniture is, it makes me not enjoy making it anymore.
Right.
And so, social media has given me the, like, basically social media opened the, people that I met on social media opened my eyes to the fact that there's other methods that you can take, to make money and still be able to be creative and have, you know, a business that's successful. And so, I don't even know if I call myself a furniture maker. I mean, I make furniture, but that's not really where my revenue lies. I have about 18 different side hustles right now that kind of all culminate into one paycheck every month.
Right.
And so, and that's like the constantly keeping up with things and juggling things, like the diversity of it all, I think, is what makes it a much more successful model for me, because there's so many different things going on that I have the opportunity to be creative when I need to be creative, but it's not something that's a forced thing. I don't like, if I don't get this piece of furniture done by this time, to this person's specific specifications, I'm not going to starve to death.
Right. Right. So it sounds like just having that variety, like, it helps you from getting bored, it sounds like, a little bit too.
Yes, definitely.
And the pressure. I'm totally that same way. And so is that kind of the idea behind the name Aunt of All Trades? Like, so you're not just a fine woodworker, like, you have a ton of different things that you're interested in.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, actually, the Aunt of All Trades thing is, I'm a musician. Well, I was a musician before I was anything else. I've been obsessed with music my entire life. And it's actually from an Alison Krauss song. He's the jack of all trades, but master of none. And someone very, a naysayer, I shall say, very early on told me, if you try to do so many things, you're never going to be good at any of them. And I was like, yeah, just watch.
and then you've done a ton of stuff. And if I was listening to an interview, right, was that even kind of the emphasis of getting into gardening as well as into, like, blacksmithing and forging?
Yeah. So a funny little side story is that when I was a kid, we used to spend a lot of time at this Living History Museum. And, that place had a huge, huge impact on me as a kid, and then now, as it turns out, later in life. And so, actually, when I realized that I could use social media as an education tool and stuff like that, I started getting really interested in the traditional side of craft and living. And that's kind of where everything devolved into the hand tool woodworking and the gardening and the blacksmithing and things like that, is because, in all honesty, I actually have been in some way basically pursuing making a bit of a Living History Museum here at the farm myself. And it's not necessarily for other people, but mostly because I as a kid was so fascinated by churning butter by hand and, you know, melting metal in the forge and things like that, that I was like, I have to have that at my house. And I really want to set something like that up for my kids to experience and things like that. So, the historical side of things is absolutely fascinating to me. And that's kind of the driver for the Aunt of All Trades. Has nothing really to do with, like, some self-glorification or anything, but really is just my pursuit to live like a modern day settler.
Yeah. So do you struggle then with maybe wanting to go really deep in a specific trade? but then being super interested in something like you've never done before? Like, is that a balance that you kind of have to walk?
Absolutely. I have, it's very tough for me to stay focused. Let's just put it that way.
So how do you, or do you?
Some days I'm much better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. So what are you into right now?
Everything.
What are you working on today? How about that?
Today I'm working on a little sculpted. Okay. Actually, well, today I was watching Downton Abbey. And they have all these, like, they bring breakfast in bed every day, to the ladies in the house. And I was like, oh man, I need one of those little tables. So today I'm working on a little breakfast in bed table.
That's awesome. I think I saw that on your Instagram story. It was like, oh, that's really cool. And I love that came from, Downton Abbey. But, so on the shop side of things, I know, you've put some great videos out there on kind of the shop build. And for people that haven't seen it, it was a, like a condemned building. Is that right? And then you just kind of built it out. And is it like separate woodworking and blacksmithing? Like kind of how do you have it set up for people that may not have seen it?
Yes. So that building is the bane of my existence. The funny thing is that when I saw this property, I was like, oh my gosh, they have a barn. There's a place for me to have a garden. And there's this huge shop. And the huge shop, I was like, at the time we had a like kind of 1.5 car garage. And again, it was a pretty bum shop. I had it set up really well. But I was like, oh my gosh, I could do so many activities in here. And so the shop was the selling point for me for the house. And I was just so excited to move into this farm and to get that shop going. The funny thing is, well, it's funny in retrospect. It was not funny at the time. Right after we moved in, the building flooded, and it turns out that the whole like structure was basically, I mean, it was not a structurally sound building. And so I was devastated because, you know, I had just like had all these dreams of doing these things, and we just bought the farm and we were completely broke. So there was nothing I could really do about it. So I ended up actually being forced to move all my tools into my laundry room. And by all my tools, I mean only the ones that would fit, because it's a tiny laundry room. And so I had to, that actually was the real catalyst for my like quote unquote, like hand tool pretension or whatever. It's just, it wasn't that I was obsessed with hand tools or that I only wanted to use hand tools. It's literally that I only had space to use hand tools, and it was inside our house. So I didn't really have the opportunity to like be making a ton of dust or anything else like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I ended up working in the laundry room for 3 years, while I saved up enough money to restore the other building or tear it down or do whatever it is that I was going to do. And so, last year, that dumbly, as I was just preparing to quit my job and was trying to like get my business started and really ramped up so that I could quit my job, I was like, oh, this would be a perfect time to restore that building. So I would go to work and then come home from work and work until like 2 or 3 in the morning, on the like doing demo and stuff in that building. And then I would get back up and do the farm chores, and then go back to work and then come home and work on the building until 2 or 3 in the morning. And I nearly died. I got pneumonia. Yeah. It was a bad thing, but I finally finished. And the wood, well, I finished the woodworking side of the thing. And so the building itself is like basically a babushka doll, if you've ever seen one. It was originally a 1-car garage, and then people just kept building onto it. So there's like the original 1950 garage, and then there's a little shelter on it, and then there's a much bigger building on it. And so I first took the biggest part of the building and I decided to make that the woodworking shop. And then I was actually going to tear down the other two sides of the building But then I found out how much the permits were going to cost just to tear it down. And I was like, well, forget this. And so I just decided to restore those. So that's what I'm working on right now, is there's going to be a, there's a 20 by, or a 22 by 24 ish, woodworking building. And then, it opens a door into the next building that I am working on restoring now, which, like, I had to jack up the roof. So I used a car jack and a 6x6 and, like, basically rebuilt the entire interior of the building piece by piece. Yeah. And that's going to be my welding and fabrication shop. And then there's the building that's attached to that, and that will be my blacksmithing shop. And I was using that building as a chicken coop for the last 3 years, so it's really disgusting in there now. So I actually was just talking to my buddy. I was like, dude, I'll pay you like this amount of money if you'll just come and help me clean that out. And he's like, I'll think about it.
I guess the nastiness of a chicken coop. I really want to put one in my backyard, but that's been like the one thing. Like, I don't know if I want to clean that thing out. That doesn't seem like fun. So the two other kind of things I wanted to ask, wrapping up, first off. So I know it sounds like you're super into, just the idea of kind of throwing it back a couple hundred years, it sounds like, kind of working with your hands and stuff. But then also, like, on your channel just a few weeks ago, it looks like you had the 3D printing nerd out there working with 3D printers. Like, how do you approach like new technology or new tools? Like, do you see that fitting into what you do currently, or do you kind of like working with like the more traditional tools that have been around and tested for a while?
I definitely do love traditional tools. But I am by no means a purist, and I think that anything that can help me get from point A to point B in a quick manner without compromising quality is, like, definitely worth it. So I have, like, the idea of 3D printing is great, except that I don't know enough about, you know, how to use a computer to make that actually work. And so for things like that, I really like working with people who know what they're doing. So for example, collaborating with Joel, the 3D printing nerd, is great because he knows everything that I need to know. But like, I'm interested in it because I'm like, hey, could we make some investment molds? Could we print them so that so that I could do some casting or something like that? So things that help me to kind of achieve my goals, I'm definitely very interested in new technology for that. Or for another example is that my buddy Nick and I have been working on, he bought a antique printing press. Like, if you ever watch Jimmy Dress's stuff, he has a bunch of these old presses. And so anyway, he and I have been working on that, and like, we've been forging some parts for it and working on restoring it so that we can use it. But I've actually been looking at getting a CNC router so that I could, cut out plates to make prints. And so in that way, I think technology is fantastic. And I definitely see myself incorporating that. And then, I mean, like, you know, I love blacksmithing, but I need to use welders and plasma cutters and things like that to be able to do that stuff. And so in that way, you know, technology is my friend.
And that's what I thought was kind of interesting, because you had mentioned like you don't like technology as much on the computer side of things, but then like you're using things that are super technical that like I have zero clue how to weld or do about an eighth of what you can do. But that's cool. Yeah, the stuff Jimmy's doing is really, I know, like, he's been seeing a lot of plates, it seems like, recently, that he's just doing, like, not even through a printing press, but he's just like pressing the paper on or like rolling it on, which is I was like, oh, that's really neat. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was, so this is, I guess, about a year since you've gone full time.
Yep.
From January 1st of last year, like, how has it gone? Like, are you at the place that you thought you would be? Is it way different than you thought it'd be? Like, how's like the last year gone being full time?
It's great and horrible and great and horrible and great and horrible. Depends on when you ask me. It's crazy. It's awesome. And I'm so, so, so thankful that I could do it. And I would say that, like, even though I don't love corporate America, I do think I have a fairly business savvy mind. And so I definitely, like, on the business side of things, like, I had a goal, or I had like goals and I had a business plan and all those things. And I've been acting those things out. And so business wise, I would say that things are going very, very well. I mean, better than I could have expected or hoped. And so that's great. And then the other side of it is, you know, I always tell anyone who asks me, like, if they should do this, or tells me that they want to do this, is basically, you have to constantly be asking yourself, like, is this fun? Because it is so much work, and so much more work than quote unquote a real job. And so you have to just constantly be checking in with yourself and asking you if you still love it. And I definitely would say that I definitely, definitely still love it. I've had some major challenges, staying focused, because there's, you know, I'm working for myself. There's no accountability. And I have 1,000 interests, and, you know, because I technically do this full time, I'm like, oh, well, I have all the time in the world to be able to do this. And it turns out that, you know, there's still deadlines that need to be met. So that has definitely been one of the tougher aspects of it. But, and I mean, really, the issue with the deadlines is not actually finishing my work on time. It's just that living on a farm, it is utter chaos all the time. Like, yeah, the best laid plans never happen.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, if you looked at it from are you working less and making more? Absolutely not. I have pulled more all-nighters this year than ever in my life combined. But, you know, I've also been able to, you know, be there when my animals are born, and, you know, take better care of everything, and be around and be fully present. And, you know, if my niece needs me to do something, like, I can stop what I'm doing and be there. And, yeah, so, I mean, it's cool, but this is definitely not a life for everyone. And ask me again next year.
two years in, where you at? Well, that's sweet. Well, I appreciate your time and chatting with this stuff you're making. It's crazy. I'm having to show my wife when, like, you're working on something new. Cause I think we were talking about a chicken coop, and I was like, oh, she's got a video on chicken coop. And then, like, the other day I'm like, oh, we need a pizza oven. And I was like, oh wait, she just made, or she like built out this full pizza oven thing. And she's like, let's get some goats. I'm like, you're like living the life I think my wife wants in like 3 years. So
perfect. It's a dangerous journey.
Yeah.
You said something about chickens. I will tell you right now that chickens are farm crack. Like, you start with a chicken, and suddenly, like, you're like, oh, could I get like 2 chickens? It would be great to have some eggs. And like, suddenly you have, 100 animals.
Oh no, that's like the intro drug. Okay. We'll have to be careful.
Yeah. It's a gateway drug for sure. But I will also say too, that like you were saying that the chicken coop is nasty and stuff like that. Birds, like, as it turns out, like, chickens on Instagram and chickens in real life, like, chickens are the grossest animal ever.
Really?
Like, yeah. I was like, oh, someday I'm going to have, you know, my own chickens, and I'm going to get eggs from my backyard every day. And then maybe I'll have some goats or whatever. I'm like, every time I get, like, I got chickens, and then I got goats, and then I got donkeys. And I'm like, forget all the other things. Like, basically everyone should just have donkeys, and that's it.
Oh, really? Okay. We'll just skip the chickens in.
Backyard. Perfect. Yeah. It's great. Your neighbors will love you. You'll have just like random children, like, stuffing carrots through your fence in any time.
Oh, that's fun. That's crazy. And you have alpacas too, right?
I do. Yes. They're great.
That's wild.
Who doesn't want to have an Ewok in their yard?
I know. That's sweet. Well, for people that do want to get more information about you that aren't already follow you, just anofalltrades.com. Is that the best place you'd send people?
Yep. You can find me at anofalltrades anywhere on the internet. Twitter, my website, YouTube, Instagram, etc. That's actually it. That's all there is. Oh, Facebook. Well, yes.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much for chatting. It's been a blast.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for hanging around to the end of the show. This is where I give you a quick update about the stuff that I have going on inside of my shop. And my shop has been pretty busy. I have been finishing up some baby gates that we are putting at the top and the bottom of our stairs. Our daughter is starting to crawl as well as starting to crawl up and downstairs. So we're trying to get those up here pretty quick. I should have that project finished, and hopefully the video will be up by the next episode that gets released next Thursday. But then a couple other big things that have been going on in the shop is, one, I got a new dust collector. That's just a Harbor Freight, kind of the 2-horsepower one. And I'm learning about the limited circuitry I've got in my shop, in my garage. So I'm kind of playing around with just 2 outlets. And so I'm trying to figure out how I can get that dust collector going, as well as my table saw, and then potentially like a CNC going without tripping any breakers. So that's a fun project, as well as some reorganizing. And then the big thing is I actually just got a 50-watt Chinese laser that got chopped off. I haven't even powered the thing on. I got it out of the box. And then I'm going to be doing a couple modifications to it and then get it up and running, as well as doing kind of a full build of what I think is going to be like an X-Carve CNC stand with the laser underneath. So I'm working with a pretty tight 2-car garage, and I'm working with half of that. So I'm trying to figure out the best use of space for that laser. But the laser is really cool, and I'll be doing some videos on that. I know a lot of people have been asking me questions about it, and I honestly don't know any answers. I have been researching and then looking forward to getting into it. But as always, I'd love to know the stuff that you guys have going on in your shop. Hit me up over the Make or Break shop. Also be looking out for that, because I just hit 10,000 followers on Instagram, and my plan is to do a giveaway here very, very soon. So you guys will be the first to know over on the podcast, as well as I'll be doing an announcement over on Instagram. I just need to get it all put together. So I hope you're doing well. Until next time, go make or break something in your shop. See you guys.